Thanks for joining us on Battle Walks as we walk across the great battlefields of Europe. If you're enjoying the show, why not become a member? Every week, you'll receive exclusive bonus episodes available only to subscribers, and you can listen to all our episodes completely ad-free. Click on the link in the show notes to join us via Acast Plus.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A Living History production.
I'm Matt McLaughlin.
And I'm Pete Smith.
We're battlefield historians who love nothing better than getting out and walking the ground where great battles in history took place.
And now we'd like you to come with us. Every week, Battle Walks will take you to one of the great battlefields of Europe.
As we walk the ground, we'll dig through the pages of history, we'll uncover the secrets of the battlefields, and most importantly, we'll tell the stories of the people who fought and died there.
Welcome to Battle Walks.
Hello everyone, welcome to Battle Walks. My name is Peter Smith, and today I'm recording the second episode of one of my out and about podcasts. We use the title Satnav Diversions, which I think explains a little on what we're doing. If you remember, for those that have listened to it, we recorded the first in a bar in Cherbourg with my good friend and V1 enthusiast Andrew Bellamy, who kept on bringing me cold beers. What could possibly go wrong? Well, I have to say, by the end of the night, it ended up with me eating a kebab in bed in my hotel room. No further comment is necessary, but we had a good evening. So again, no Matt McLaughlin, my normal co-host. This is just myself. So where are we actually recording today? Well, I'm actually back at home. I'm in my study in Flers on the Somme. So, where had we been? Well, it's day three that we're going to be looking at of a tour looking at V1 sites, but this is mainly going to be about all of those things that we find on the routes, just casually while we're travelling around using the sat-nav mainly, so hence the title Sat-Nav Diversions. So the first hour on scheduled stops was for a coffee. We had visited, I don't know, a good half a dozen V1 sites by then, been in and out of the car multiple times. And so a coffee in one of the local bars. And I highly recommend, if you are travelling in rural France and you're just exploring, make sure you use the local bars. A, I feel putting a bit of money into the local economy, but B, that's where you get the information from. And you really feel kind of, it's not tourist France, I suppose. It's proper rural France, so I enjoy the bars. And in this case, we met a young couple who came across to have a chat with us and pointed us in a couple of directions. But the reason for stopping was A, there was a bar in the town, which are getting harder to find, but B, there was an enormous chateau. So where are we? Well, the town is called Bricquebec. The full title, Bricquebec en Cotentin, and that's we're on the Cotentin Peninsula, which is very close to the landing beaches for D-Day, and we're actually making our way behind the landing beaches and heading back towards Paris slowly. That's the route that we're going to, the direction we're going to be heading in. So why stop here? Well, as I said, coffee, but also there was a very obvious chateau. So the Château de Bricquebec, which is what we wanted to go and have a look at. It's a medieval fortress. The man that actually that we're interested in, the Chevalier of Lyon, So the Green Lion Knight doesn't sound quite as good when you say it in English. Chevalier of Lyon, the Green Lion Knight. That's the guy that we're going to be chatting about. Robert VIII, Bertrand de Bricubec. He was living from 1273 to 1348. So I'm well out of my comfort zone here, but it's just interesting, as you'll see as I, again, what we do is we read the panels, go and have a look at what we can see. So a lovely fortress. You can imagine the type of medieval Norman castle that we're looking at. So a little bit about this guy. So during 1322, Robert accompanied his father-in-law, with other French knights, into the service of King Edward II of England. And this is where I thought it was interesting. They fought for England against the King Robert I of Scotland. And during a decisive meeting at the Battle of the Old Byland on the 14th of October 1322 in Yorkshire, they actually lost. And the French knights remained on the battlefield after the English were defeated and they were made prisoner. So not a particularly good first sully to England, but I just found it interesting, that connection with England. Here we are in rural France. To give you an idea of the level that this guy was at, in 1325 he was appointed Marshal of France by King Charles the Fourth of France. And again, another connection to one of our previous podcasts, the Battle of Castle. So in 1328, the Marshal returned to Flanders following a new revolt of the Flemish, this time accompanied by the new King Philip the Fifth of France. And the Flemish rebels, commanded by Nicholas Zannekin, were annihilated by the French Royal Army at the Battle of Castle. So a connection to a previous podcast for those that have listened to it about Castle. Moving on. The Hundred Years' War between France and England, and Bertrand was ordered to occupy the island of Guernsey for the English, to keep it from the English, should I say. And he was appointed Lord of Guernsey, and a position he held until Guernsey was recaptured by the English in July 1345. Resigned as Marshal of France in 1344, so the year before, and he was age 71 at that time. So long lived, I suppose, for that period. His final battle was an attempt to stop the English landing when King Edward III landed in Normandy on the 12th of July in 1346. And him and his son had to retire, only 30 survivors of his troop, in trying to stop the English landing. And he then sought refuge at Caen, which was laid under siege. The chateau at Caen was sieged, and eventually the siege was lifted. And he died in 1348. So quite a long-lived guy for that period. So we had a wander around the castle and the keep, and into the parkland around it. It's all very attractive, I have to say. And we found a rather odd thing. We found a pyramid in one of the gardens. It's called the Memory Pyramid. It's about the size of a domestic car. And it's in concrete. But within the concrete, and this is what caught our eye immediately, there are basically guns and helmets just sticking out of the helmet, out of the pyramid, and shell cases and all sorts of bits and bobs sticking out of it. It's a bit like excavating dinosaur bones. And it was created in 2000 to mark the passing of the previous century. And we noted on the panel that it actually was commemorating conflict and the passing of time in the area. And the actual concrete was made with sand from Utah Beach, which I thought was quite moving. So interesting modern piece of architecture, but well worth going to have a look at. Walking through one of the entrance gates, the keeps into the town, we're actually leaving the town, walking beyond the fortifications, we came across a bronze memorial to General Le Morois. I think that's how he pronounced his name. It looks like that anyway. You know, for those who have listened to me before will know my French pronunciations are appalling. This is a bronze statue. to this general who was actually born in Bricquebec, and he's he became Napoleon's aide-de-camp during his campaigns, and his period was 1776 to 1836. I'm not going to go into the whole of his history. There's an awful lot about him, but interesting guy. Again, we'll be doing a Facebook page to go with the podcast, and I'll be putting up photographs of all of these things that we're visiting, and there's going to be a picture of this general. So after we've had this the good walk around the town and several coffees and the chat with the young couple, we were off again in the car. I often wonder how many times we get in and out of the car on one of these days. It's quite a lot of time, a lot of in and outs and driving and using the sat nav, and it can be fairly tiring by the end of the day. But anyway, fairly fresh at this point. And the first thing we came across, literally a couple of kilometres outside the town, was a memorial to a B-26 Marauder from the 322nd Bomber Group, 9th United States Army Air Force, so Second World War Marauder bomber that had crashed here. I'm just flicking through my pictures now so I can look at each picture. I've got them on my iPad beside me, so I know what I'm talking about. So the memorial was a flagpole, stone-built, a small wall with a black marble tablet in the middle. And what we just found just comical, and in this case it can be comical, because the name of the plane was Hess for Six. I thought it was a fantastic name, and in this case it's not prophetic, as all of them survived the crash. And it crashed at this location on the 13th of April 1944, so all six crewmen surviving. Five were taken prisoner, and one managed to evade. And he was Sergeant Waldo W. Shows. And I'm now going to pick up a piece of paper, because, again, this is the great joy of going on one of these sat-nav diversions and stopping to read these things. Thankfully, nowadays, with the internet and everything else that you can access, we're quite quickly able to find out the basic information about the plane. But when I got back home here in my study, I was able to download his escape and evasion report, which is just absolutely fascinating. There's pages of it about how he managed to escape. So I'm just going to read just a few little bits from his report, because it's just so interesting. So this is Sergeant Waldo Shows. I was engineer in a B-26 on a mission to bomb some gun emplacements near Le Havre on April the 13th. Although the weather was poor, we dropped our bombs as scheduled and started for home. Passing through some thick clouds over the channel, we lost the rest of our flight. After a while, we saw a coastline which we supposed was England, but I could not hear our home beacon, and the radio compass reckoning was all wrong. I told the co-pilot, who fired a Vary cartridge, hoping to get some ground signals in return. Instead, quite a lot of flak came up, so we knew we were still over France. I went back to try to get another bearing. The bell rang just after this, and the pilot told us to jump, and we all went out the bomb bay doors, except the pilot, who was still in the ship when I left. I fell about 1,000 feet before opening my chute, but came down easily and was first man to touch the ground. I saw four other chutes coming down some distance away, but never made contact with the rest of the crew, and I was later told that they'd all been captured by the Germans. I narrowly missed a telephone wire and was fired at by some Germans as I landed. I ran about 200 yards into some woods, threw my chute and Mae West in a pool of water, and hid there for about an hour. At the edge of the woods, an old lady walked past. She smiled and pointed back down the road. Soon, two young Frenchmen came running, calling Bosch and motioning me to hide. Some Germans on motorcycles followed. Just turning the page. We pull some leaves over, I pull some leaves over myself, and the Germans comb the woods and question the French people who came down the road, but they did not find me. I stayed there in the rain for 3 hours until everybody had gone away. Then I came out and walked about a quarter of a mile and hid in a hedge when another German passed. Finally, I went to another half mile and hid in a field until nightfall. I'm not going to read all of it. It goes on and on and on. But effectively, he's looked after by the French. He's moved several locations and hidden in barns, in buildings. And then when the landings take place, he has a decision to make to continue and hide with the French, who actually start heading south away from the landing, or to wait until the Americans arrive and hopefully evade the Germans and eventually give himself up. And that's exactly what he does. So I'll just read this little account. We walked north along the coast using a map drawn by a man who said he'd been a captain in the British Army in the last war. I found that fascinating. Who on earth was that? We went through one town where the Germans had moved out, but the Americans had not yet arrived. There was little artillery fire in the distance at times, and we saw a few observation planes. Eventually gets to Barnville, and three other Frenchmen joined him, who were also hoping to get through the lines and to the American commander. They had information to pass. They were resistance fighters. And eventually ran into an American military policeman who looks at his dog tags. He's in civilian clothes, so he was worried about a bit of the fact he was in civilian clothes. Waved him through and took him to where he wanted to go. So I won't read any more, but it absolutely fascinating account. For those that want to track it down, then you can, from his name, and I'll put a link to it on the website as well. So having had a look at this memorial, we then lit back in the car again, and no exaggeration, about another couple of kilometres down the road, and we spotted another memorial, and this one was in fact to a Wellington, a little difficult to read, but it's a Wellington Mark 4 from 458 Squadron RAF, and it crashed here on Friday the 9th of January 1942. And this memorial has been put up by the local commune of Golville, and it was erected in 2008. It's a lovely memorial. It's just slightly difficult to read. You have to get out very close to it. So again, we were able to get some information, and they were attacking targets in Cherbourg. And their base had been home on Spalding Moor, which is in Lincolnshire, I think. Six-man crew, three Australians, two British and one New Zealander. Sadly, they all lost their lives in the crash. And so, again, we were able to track down a little bit of information about them. 31 aircraft taking part in this raid, and of the 31, four were lost. And it is thought that Wellington R1785, which is its registration number, was hit by a flak and crashed at 7:23 hours in the morning, killing all the crew. And it wasn't until March 1946 that their bodies were actually recovered. And interestingly, we've already visited their graves, because on the previous podcast, one of the last things we did was visit the CWGC, Commonwealth War Graves, plot in Cherbourg, Old Communal Cemetery, and they're all buried in there together. So again, I've photographed most of them, and so I'll be putting up those photographs on the Facebook page as well. So I'd actually written down who the guys were. Shall I go through everybody? I don't think we will. I don't think we'll go through everybody. I'll add that information. You'll see it on the Facebook page. I just found it very moving. I was reading their epitaphs on some of their graves, and very, very moving. So, again, having paid our respects, we always carry, as I mentioned in the previous podcast, we always carry a few poppy wreaths about, or poppy crosses, or even just the individual poppies. We always leave something on each one, each memorial that we come across, just to say we've been. And off we went again. And again, probably about 20 minutes further down the road, this one was really extraordinary. Round the corner, I have no idea how we say this, the commune of Nehu. That's what it looks like. No doubt you do not pronounce it like that. And it's General George S. Patton's command post was based here from the 6th of July to the 2nd of August in 1944. Well, how do we know that? Well, because there was a Sherman tank at the side of the road. Lucky Forward, the name emblazoned on the side of it, with the insignia of the American Third Army. So that was extraordinary to just go around a little tiny rural road and there's a Sherman tank at the side of the road. And beside it was one of the famous Liberty Road markers. That flaming torch of liberty, which is supposed to be emerging from the sea and being carried eastward along the roads that are the Liberty Road that will take us eventually all the way from Normandy, from Utah Beach to Bastogne. That's the route that it takes. And, so great to see one of these. I've come across them. I guide up around Bastogne. So it was nice to see one of the Liberty Road markers. The domed top has the 48 stars representing the states. Then at that time, during the liberation of France. In fact, the whole thing was actually a French idea. It was a guy called, in fact, Guy de la Vasselet, had been the liaison officer to Patton, and he suggested the idea of erecting a monument to commemorate the liberation of France by the American armies. And so there's one every kilometre all the way from, as I say, from Utah Beach, going all the way to Bastogne. So nice to have a look at that. A lot of panels explaining about what had gone on here, and that it was Patton's headquarters, and so interesting, well worth having a look at those. So again, off we go, off we went again, and we're heading this time. We're actually heading towards Bayeux, the town of Bayeux, which is where we're going to stay for the first night. Sorry, just quickly looking at my photographs to make sure I'm not missing anything. No. Okay. Oh, just before we leave here, just a little bit more about the fact that this was Patton's headquarters, because I did wonder when I read it. I thought, well, if it's his command post, I wonder where he was sleeping. Was it in one of the buildings in the area and in the village itself? And it wasn't. He had his trailer caravan here, along with his general staff. General Gaffey and General Gay, they were both with their own trailer caravans as well. And so the command post was actually a tent in amongst them. And it does point out that there was an orchard just beside where this memorial site is. And it's within that orchard that they'd set up their command post. And in fact, there's only one tree left. It points out that there's just one tree left from the original orchard. So interesting. So off we go again. And we're heading to Bayeux, famous for its tapestry. And we're going to check into our hotel, which we're staying at this time, the Churchill. Other hotels are available, but the Churchill Hotel, wonderfully named and very relevant to where we are. And what I wanted to do was, once we checked in, was to actually go across and have a look at the cathedral. The cathedral is fantastic, managed to survive the war without being overly damaged. And why I wanted to go inside it was to have a look at the memorial tablet. So what memorial tablet are we talking about? Well, between 1923 and 1936, the Imperial War Graves Commission erected a series of tablets in All of the cathedrals in France that had a connection to the war, to the war, either troops were based nearby or wounded or casualty evacuations. And they decided to put a commemorative plaque up commemorating the Empire's dead of the First World War. So it's an Empire Memorial, which is very moving. So very colourful. And the prototype, which I know very well, and that's one of the reasons why I wanted to go and have a look at this memorial tablet in the cathedral, is because the prototype, which is slightly different, is in Amiens Cathedral, very close to where I am at the moment in Flers. It's only half an hour away. So I go to that fairly regularly when I'm touring and take clients to go and look at the commission's tablet there. So, yeah, nice to go and have a look at that. I took some photographs of that, which I'll be posting as well. It's actually got the Royal Coat of Arms and those of India and the Imperial Dominions, so South Africa, Australia, Canada, New Zealand and Newfoundland, they're all on there. So it's a great memorial to the Empire. And it commemorates the 600,000 dead. And so it's of Britain and Ireland. When I read that, and I'm sure somebody's going to correct me on this, but that's not the total dead. So 600,000 dead of Britain and Ireland. If this is an Empire memorial, does that mean that the Empire dead is commemorated in that number? When I read that number, don't know. Doesn't big numbers never kind of work well for me? So I'm not sure. But that's dedicated to the 600,000 dead of Britain and Ireland. So the inscription on the tablet was written by Rudyard Kipling, and that refers to the million dead of the Empire. So that's kind of more relevant, I think, because that's the figure that I normally say, a million dead for the Empire, very broad brush, but it kind of gives you a feeling of it. So how many of these are there? Well, there are 28 cathedrals and churches within France that carry plaques, 23 in France. There are also 5 in Belgium as well. And they're bilingual, so their inscription is either in English. It's either English, French, or Latin, respectively. Interesting that it's not in Flemish, but anyway. Or maybe it is.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
There's also one that was unveiled in Westminster Abbey. So there's one in Westminster Abbey as well, and that one was unveiled in 1926 in St. George's Chapel. There are also others, replicas or copies, one in Hamilton and Vancouver in Canada. There's one in Baghdad in Iraq. One in Delville Wood, literally can see Delville Wood from the window here. That's South African. One in Fremantle, Australia, and in Liverpool. So there's quite a few to go and have a look at. Track them down. Go and have a look at them. They're very colourful and moving. Now, the other reason that I wanted to go and have a look at the cathedral was actually something that was outside of the cathedral. So we're just going to leave the cathedral again. Oh, I'm just going to talk about something in the cathedral. Always makes me smile. One of the paintings on the wall paintings, the murals, is of Thomas the Becket having the top of his head sliced off in Canterbury Cathedral in Britain. I often wonder why the French are commemorating that. But it's painted on the wall again. I'll post a picture of it, well worth having a look at if you're wandering about inside the cathedral. So out of the cathedral, back towards the road, and on the right-hand side, there's a wall, and on that wall there's a memorial to the 50th Northumbrian Division, and it's a division that has a big attachment for me. I'm from East Yorkshire and went to school in Beverley, which is very much in their recruiting area. So right at the top of the memorial, there's the double T of the Tyne and Tees. So it's the Tyne and Tees, a river. So these capital T's overlapping slightly, one slightly below the other. That's the divisional patch as well. You'd find it on the vehicles, on the sleeves of the men serving in the division. So Tyne and Tees, two rivers, and the recruiting area, the base of it was in between those two rivers. And it's a territorial division. Part-time soldiers. And then the text on it, to the glory of God and in memory of all ranks of the 50th Northumbrian Division who laid down their lives for justice, freedom and the liberation of France in the assault on the beaches of La Rivière, Le Hamel and Arromanches on the 6th of June 1944 and in the battles on the fields of Normandy. The town of Bayeux, the first town in France to be liberated by the Allied armies, was entered and freed by troops of this division on the morning of the 7th of June, 1944. So as I said, this division has always been one that that interests me. And the 69th Brigade of the division, they landed at Gull Beach, included the 5th East Yorks, the 6th Green Howards, and the 8th Green Howards. And interestingly, the 6th Green within the 6th Green Howards, we have CSM Company Sergeant Major Stanley Hollis, who's awarded the Victoria Cross, and he is the only man to be awarded the Victoria Cross on D-Day, which is interesting in its own right. So Stanley Hollis's memorial I very often visit. But there's an interesting connection for my Australian listeners, is that the officer, and I haven't got his name to hand, but the officer that recommended him for the Victoria Cross was actually an Australian. He was an Australian exchange officer who'd been attached to the 69th Brigade for experience. Of course, Australian troops looking that they may have to invade Japan in the future. So a few Australians were embedded, using a modern word, with the infantry on D-Day to have the experience of landing. And this officer, he was the one that that recommended Stanley Hollis for the Victoria Cross. So a nice little Australian connection. Of course, I'm generally speaking more interested in the same division during the First World War. And at that point, they were in the 150th Brigade. And that included the 1st of the 4th East Yorks, the 1st of the 4th Yorkshire Regiment, the 1st of the 5th Yorkshire Regiment, and the 1st of the 5th Durham Light Infantry. So it's, again, it's the same area. An interesting division. The divisional patch had changed between the two world wars. It was, the First World War, it was a red, unicorn's head. As I say, in Second World War, or just after the First War, it changed to the double T's. So, we then had a good evening meal and a night's sleep before the following morning. Off we went again. little irritation of mine while we were there. There's a shop there that I visit quite often, and it has hundreds of issues of various French military magazines. But unfortunately, it was closed. And there's an awful lot more to see in the town of Bayeux as well. And in fact, I'm not going to talk about what else there is to see, because I think we could actually do a podcast about the town itself. So off we go. And we're heading off northwards and east, because we're now heading towards Paris, looking at V1 storage sites. And also, we've identified certain cemeteries we want to go to, where there are the graves of downed airmen who died attacking those V1 sites and the associated infrastructure, because we're getting beyond, or we will eventually be beyond, the firing points and into the storage areas. So, we'd stopped at multiple sites before we get to the little village of Marbois, and there I found something that is extraordinary. Now, I don't know the answer to this story, so I'm going to explain what we discover, and then I'm hoping that somebody out there, one of you, can try and track down some more information about this chap. So we're visiting the graves of airmen who died attacking the V1 sites, but behind them was another headstone that had the dimensions and size of the standard CWGC marker. But on the grave marker, but on the front of it was a marble plaque. On that marble plaque was the badge of the Royal Air Force's Escaping Society. And it's on a plaque kind of stuck onto the front. Well, it's screwed on, actually, screwed onto the front of this standard Commonwealth War Graves headstone. But then looking at the inscription on the headstone, it says Flight Lieutenant D.C. Webb, RAF Fighter Pilot, and then it's in French. So I'm going to read it in French, and then I'm sure you'll get the gist of what it says. So, Abattu June 1944, et recueilli par ses amis français. Born the 4th of August 1921, died the 13th of November 1992. Effectively, in my absolute appalling French, what that is saying is shot 1944 and recovered by French friends. Now, interestingly, that obviously is a Google translation. So it's shot down in June 1944 and then looked after by French friends. So, what's it mean? Well, the answer is I have no idea. It just doesn't make any sense to me. This is his grave. So he obviously died here in November 1992. He had friends here. He was obviously shot down here. But that's all we can do. There is nothing else other than that's on the headstone. I've tried tracking him down. I can't track him down at all. The Royal Air Force Forces Escaping Society was a UK-based charity formed in 1946, and it was created to help those people in the former occupied territories who had risked their lives to assist downed airmen, in other words, those attempting to escape and to evade capture. So it was formed, nothing to do with the air crew themselves. This is to assist after the war, the people who are in difficulties for whatever reason, widows of people that were died, after they'd helped people. So either executed or sent to a concentration camp, or just find themselves in difficulty. It's to help those people who assisted downed airmen. So why is that on his headstone? Because he is one of the airmen. So it just doesn't make sense. So it was disbanded in 1995, so it doesn't exist any longer. Have they got records of members and things? Not really. Nothing that I could really track down. I went to the Air Force's Escape and Evasion Society, which is actually American run, but it covers everybody. He's not listed there in that I can locate. So anyway, it's fascinating. It's an interesting research project for somebody. To see if they can track down anything else about this chap. So Flight Lieutenant D.C. Webb. So he was a really good sat-nav diversion here, one that we can't really, I can't get to the get to the bottom of. So off we go, again. A bit more of a leisurely drive, and not too far. And we're now about 100 kilometres outside of central Paris. And this was a church we were going to have a look at, a place called Oulins. I'm going to spell it O-U-L-I-N-S, Oulins. That's an English pronunciation. And on the side of the church is a little granite, polished granite, red granite plaque. And it's to Warrant Officer Hilton Craig Bell, Royal Australian Air Force. And this is what it actually says. Hilton Craig Bell, Aviator de la Royal Air Force, deceased le 8 juillet 1944, à l'âge de 21 ans. And it's les habitants Oulan reconnaissance. So basically, it's commemorating his loss here on the 8th of July in 1944, and the fact he was 21 years old, and it's been put up by the villagers. Now, interestingly, why is it on the side of the wall? Well, he's missing. So I looked him up quickly. He's on the Air Force's memorial at Runnymede, just known as the Runnymede Memorial. If you want to know where that is, about 4 miles outside of Windsor and overlooking the River Thames. And it commemorates the over 20,000 airmen who were lost and have no known grave during the war. So the question is, why is he commemorated here? Why is he on this wall in a rural French church? Just behind me, literally across the gravel path, I can see a row of three Commonwealth War Graves headstones. Walking across to them, I discover that they all died on the same night. So I'll just read you an account of what happened. On the night of the 7th of July 1944, Lancaster ME-668 took off from Metheringham as part of a squadron attack on the flying bomb dump at Saint-Loup-d'Essarent. And that's why we're here. That's why we came here, was to see the crewman. We didn't know about this plaque on the wall. And they had fierce opposition was encountered by the formation, and ME-668, that's its number, did not return to base after the raid. Following post-war inquiries and investigations, it was established that the aircraft crashed and exploded at Les Gatines de Oulins, France, some 33 kilometres north of Dreux. Four crew members were killed, and three became prisoners of war. So, there we get the story. Four crew members killed, and three became prisoners of war. Three of those crew members are buried in this cemetery, and one is commemorated on the wall here. So we have to ask ourselves why. So let's just run through the names of the men. Warrant Officer Hilton Craig Bell. This is the Australian who's commemorated on the wall. He was the wireless operator, age 21. Sergeant William Burt Gladstone. He's RAF. Bell is Royal Australian Air Force. He's the mid-upper gunner, age 19, and he's commemorated here in the cemetery, or buried here in the cemetery. Flying Officer William Gordon Hardcastle, he's RAF, he's a navigator, age 24. He's also buried here in the cemetery. Flying Officer A.G. Kinnis was the air bomber, he's prisoner of war, and Flight Lieutenant Geoffrey Norman Merchant, he's the pilot and he's prisoner of war. Then Flying Officer Frank Gordon Patterson, Royal Canadian Air Force, he's the rear gunner and he's buried in the cemetery. And then finally, Sergeant F. Wells, Royal Air Force, and he's a flight engineer and he's a prisoner of war. So, basically, after the war, in the investigations, It was recorded that the remains of Warrant Officer Bell could not be located. The other three crewmen who died were located and they're buried in the cemetery. And so I just find it fascinating and very moving that the French, having discovered this and knowing this and knowing that his body was not recovered, have decided to make sure that he is commemorated along with the three crewmen who died and are buried in their parish cemetery. And I don't think it's extraordinary, really. And we find it over and over again in French villages that they're commemorating the men and women who died within their communes to free them from the occupation during World War II. And I think it just makes this plaque remarkable, really, that the villagers desired and needed to commemorate this man who should lie, I suppose, with his comrades. But because his body wasn't found and couldn't be found, they felt it necessary to put this plaque up. And, you know, don't let anybody tell you that the French don't care, because they certainly do. I'll just read you a final report of the that was from one of the crewmen that survived. So it's the actual pilot. Flight Lieutenant Marchant reported, they crossed the French coast at 12,000 feet in the vicinity of Drew when the aircraft's starboard inner engine was hit by a flak and caught fire. He ordered the engineer to feather the airscrew and operate the extinguisher button, which was done. As the fire did not subside, he ordered the crew to abandon the aircraft. Immediately afterwards, it was hit from each quarter by two enemy fighters. And Flight Lieutenant Merchant states that Warrant Officer Bell and Sergeant Gladstone lost their lives in the air. So in other words, they were killed by in the attack as they're trying to bail out. The engineer and bomb aimer bailed out at 12,000 feet. The aircraft was governable but had no lateral control, and there was fire in all four engines, the bomb bay and most of the fuselage. The top of the cockpit was blown away and the aircraft went into a shallow spin. Flight Lieutenant Marchant bailed out through the cockpit top at 500 feet and states that the aircraft crashed near the town of Drew. So, amazing story, very moving. So, back to the car, and off we go again. And again, we're not travelling far to the village of Corgent to visit the graves of the crew from another downed bomber. So, this one really isn't a sat-nav diversion, because this is the story, this is something we were going to see, and it's just part of our visit. But it's such an interesting story, and what we discovered was so interesting that I've decided to incorporate it into this podcast, even though strictly speaking it's not a sat-nav diversion, it was a planned visit. So this is the crew of Lancaster LM338 of 467 Squadron from RAF Waddington in Lincolnshire, and it crashed in this vicinity on the 8th of July 1944. So we're in the communal cemetery in the village of Corgent, I presume. So I'll just tell you a little bit about the plane. What they were trying to do, again, why we are visiting them, is because they are bombing V1 storage sites. So intelligence reports indicated an attack on the 4th and 5th of July on St. Lou succeeded in blocking all approaches to the caves, and this is where they were actually storing the V1s. That a large quantity of earth above the caves had fallen into them. It was also known that the Germans were making tremendous efforts to repair this damage. So a similar force of 228 Lancasters just shows you how they viewed these the V1s and the firing of the V1s, how important it was to stop them. So 228 Lancasters attacked again on the 7th, the night of the 7th and 8th of July. There was fairly heavy cloud cover over the target at 18,000 feet. So the Australians of number 463 and 467 squadrons came below this height to attack and again reported good results.
Enemy ground fire was far more evident than on the first occasion, and although a mandrel screen was in operation to confuse enemy night fighters, the Germans brought up reinforcements from the Low Countries, and 31 Lancasters were shot down. A disappointing high percentage for an attack on northern France, but one which clearly showed the importance in German eyes of protecting Saint-Lô-d'Oisiret. Daylight reconnaissance later showed large new craters over the entrance to the three main tunnels, roads and rail approaches had been blocked and appeared to be beyond immediate repair. In addition, the riverbanks had been badly cratered, which had caused flooding. Now, this is the interesting fact about this attack. For 10 days after this second attack on St. Lô, the daily average of flying bomb attacks fell from about 100 to less than 70. Now, that doesn't sound like a massive reduction, but it is at a time when we are really under the pump as far as the V1s. So Lancaster LM338 had taken off from RAF Waddington at 22 hours on the night of 7th of July 1944 to bomb flying bomb storage sites at Saint-Lô-d'Oisiret, France. A bomb load of 11 1,000-pound bombs and four 500-pound bombs. And nothing was heard from the aircraft after takeoff, and it did not return to base. 18 aircraft from the squadron took part in the raid, and two of these, including LM338, failed to return. And post-war, it was established that the aircraft had crashed at Courgeot. So the whole crew are commemorated here. As we walk, so a little bit about our arrival. So it's a very rural road and down a gentle slope, and the cemetery's at the bottom on the right-hand side, and we turned round and pulled up in front. And we walked down towards the graves, and the graves are immediately obvious as you enter the cemetery. It's very beautiful, very attractive wooded area in a valley, woods at both sides. And as we walked to the graves, it became immediately obvious that this was not your normal standard grave, because we could see that one of the props from the aircraft was behind the graves. So a propeller's sticking out of the ground. And then another memorial behind that as well, a cross. So we walked round to the front and started reading the inscriptions. The first thing that we noted was this cross, which I suspect was the original marker before the Commonwealth War Graves set up their headstones. And it said, here lie seven British aviators. In their glorious tombs, who died in aerial combat on the night of the 7th and 8th of July 1944. Notice I didn't this time decide not to read it in the French. And then the propeller blades are behind them. And in front is a photograph of the crew, a framed photograph of the crew as well. So we were just looking at all of this, and the mayor came through the gate. We didn't know he was the mayor at the time, and popped across to see what we were doing. I think he was worried that we were going to nick the propeller blades. He wasn't really. He came across to have a chat with us and to find out. And Andrew, of course, is Australian, and the crew are Australians, or almost all Australians. And so he was interested that an Australian had made the effort to come here and stayed with us quite a while, having a chat before he headed off. And so that was nice to meet the mayor while we were there. And then we had a look at the private inscriptions on the bottom of the headstones, which are very moving. And I'm going to go through the crew here because I think it's just nice to remember them and to read their names. So Flight Sergeant Van Edward Cockcroft, he was the bomb aimer, and he was from Toowoomba in Queensland. And his private epitaph, extraordinary: "Dauntless, you leapt to heights untold, dying. You live forever, beloved." A very moving headstone. Sergeant George Arthur Hayes, flight engineer. Now, he's RAF, and he's from Forest Hall in Northumberland. Very simple in private inscription: "Thy will be done." Warrant Officer Clifford Cecil Jones. He's the navigator, Royal Australian Air Force, from Ballarat, Victoria. "A son and brother, beloved and ever remembered." He was 23. Sergeant William Delden Douglas Kilworth, Royal Australian Air Force air gunner. age 20. He's from Scottsdale in Tasmania. His duty nobly done, ever remembered. Flight Sergeant Leonard Haig Porritt, Royal Australian Air Force, wireless operator, air gunner. Age 23, he's from Beechworth in Victoria. Loved and remembered, longed for always. Very moving. Flying Officer Philip Wyatt Ryan, pilot, Royal Australian Air Force, age 22, and he's also from Beechworth in Victoria, so they obviously knew each other, Porritt and Ryan, and he was age 22. No private epitaph on his headstone. And then Flight Sergeant James Pat Stephan, Royal Australian Air Force, air gunner, age 20, and he's from Mount Lawley, Western Australia. His duty nobly done. So the whole crew lie in the cemetery. So we spent quite a lot of time here, just talking about them and looking them up while we were there, and reading their epitaphs. So we got back in the car, and it just shows you how you don't notice things. We drove back up the road that we'd just driven down, and literally 100 yards up the road, we noticed another memorial, and it's a stone memorial built almost like a tomb. For those of you that know the Stone of Remembrance in the Commonwealth War Grave Cemeteries, you'll know that's what it looked like. It's like that, but in a darker stone. Central plaque, the glorious aviators of the Allies died for our liberty, 8th of July 1944, again written in French. And then their names again cast on two panels side by side. And what we realised is that the plane had literally crashed 100 kind of yards or so up the road from where the cemetery is. So their bodies were recovered from very, very close to the cemetery. And in fact, it also explains why the prop is there, because the prop was just literally 100 yards up the road from one of the engines, and it was brought down to be placed on their graves when they were buried there. So the whole thing just very moving. And as I said, worthwhile adding to the sat-nav diversions, even though it, strictly speaking, is not a diversion. It was planned. So that really ended the second day. We carried on, and in fact we stayed in a accommodation on the outskirts of Paris before carrying on. And so there is the potential, I'm going to call a halt there, but there is a potential for a third sat-nav diversions, and perhaps we'll do that in the near future. So I hope you've enjoyed it. I must close with a big thank you to Andrew, who keeps planning these little outings, very enjoyable that they are. Right, time for another cup of tea. Talk again soon. Ta-ra, as they say in Yorkshire.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. If you would like to support the show, there's a couple of ways you can do it. Firstly, you can become a member. For a small monthly fee, you can subscribe to the show and listen to every episode ad-free, and also receive exclusive episodes directly from Pete and I. So see the link in the show notes to sign up at Acast Plus and become a member of the show. Also, if you want to make a one-off contribution, you can now buy us a coffee. Visit buymeacoffee.com/battlewalks and you can make a small contribution there. See you next week.